I think we're started. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I will. I'll give a quick introduction. My name is Jeff Shelton of EngineeringRevision.com. I'm a mechanical engineer who graduated from Purdue back in 1981. Eventually, got a degree from Stanford in mechanical engineering. Eventually, got an MBA. And not having enough school, I'm currently back at Purdue again trying to finish up my PhD because I wanted to go back and teach engineering. So I've got a little background in the engineering field. And when Chris offered the opportunity to get together with him and have a podcast to kind of talk about the philosophical aspects of engineering, I said, that's a great idea and I want to be a part of it. So
I didn't know you were going back to teach.
Yeah, so I had, after doing the contracting thing for about 15 years, I said, I've had enough of this being a one-man band, and I'd like to share some of the things I'd learned, and if you want to teach engineering at the university level, you have to go back and get a PhD. So as painful as it was for me to have to pull out my calculus book and refresh myself on basic math, I did so I could go back and chase that. So hopefully I'm about done.
For people, I shouldn't say for people, many people do not know who I am, most of all me. My name is Chris Gamble. I'm an electrical engineer. I'm also a host of a podcast called The Amp Hour, which is what made me think of doing another podcast. This is a sickness of mine, and I've pulled Jeff into my into my sickness. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I went to Case Western Reserve. I have only a bachelor's degree, and I probably will stay that way unless I catch the bug like Jeff did.
And it's a painful disease.
It is expensive.
It is expensive also.
Hmm. And this is kind of a new thing. I mean, we're trying an engineering podcast. I do a circuit podcast, I try and take it into engineering often, but really the Amp Hour is about circuits. This is going to be a little bit more the engineering side of it. I mean, the philosophy of engineering, right, Jeff? I mean,
yeah, we talked about wanting to sort of explore the aspects of why we became engineers, why we like engineering. When people ask us whether they should become engineers, what the benefits are of being an engineer. So sort of more the philosophical aspect rather than the day-to-day skills that are involved in engineering.
Right. Also, because I have no idea what a mechanical engineer does, I would never be able to be one. Unless you count Google SketchUp.
That counts.
Okay. That counts. Right. Then I can be a mechanical engineer.
Well, you said earlier you're working on connectors. That's mechanical in my book.
Not when you're just saying I need six connectors or six pins, but yeah.
Well, that's if you're a mechanical engineer and you're a catalog engineer where you're basically just ordering stuff out of the catalog, not much difference.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and I keep thinking of all these topics we could talk about on this show, but I mean, there's just these days you don't get to be one kind of engineer, which is why I think it's good timing for us to talk about more generalized topics, because every engineer is expected to be the any engineer, or the every engineer more specifically, you know, the do everything, be the project manager, be the mechanical, be the electrical, yeah, be the civil. I don't know.
Right. Right. And the world's becoming a lot more complicated. You know, we've got all these technologies that are starting to interact, and there are always, you know, unintended consequences to these interactions. It takes an engineering mind sometimes to break these things down and find the underlying causes. And so I think there's a need for engineers to play a greater role in society as opposed to being the guys that sit in the back room and do the calculations. I think engineers need to be a little more vocal in getting out there and explaining what the positives and the negatives are of the technical decisions that society decides to make.
That's a good point. That's, you know, moving forward, I really do think, I mean, we always hear about the importance of STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math, but the importance of that in, you know, the workplace and everything else. And they're not always talking about just having people to run calculations or design a circuit or, you know, machine a new widget. it's often because you want that critical thinking ability, and they want that in many different aspects. They want you to be able to be a critical thinker. And so that's kind of the idea behind the common tie between all engineers, really.
Right, right. And so if you're a great critical thinker, it does no good if that's only in your own head.
Right.
And so engineers also, as we go forward and we teach engineers and we train them how to work well with other technical people, other engineers, as well as with society at large, they're going to have better communication skills. I mean, this has been an ongoing mantra for 40 years in engineering education, that we need better communication skills. But it really is true. If you can't express why this technical problem has a social implication, no one cares. No one will listen to you. And that's a problem.
Right. And hopefully, if we ever have any listeners on this show, I think the podcasting listening audience is often looking for new ideas and looking for ways to get their voices out. And I think that eventually we'll have other voices on this show and be able to expose a lot of those different ideas and get a lot of different perspectives and feedback and everything else.
Right. I certainly hope so. We had talked a little bit earlier about, making this as much a interview podcast as a conversation podcast. And I'd like to do that just because there's so many bright people out there who have so many great ideas about how to improve either education at large or engineering education specifically, that I'd love to talk to those people and learn from them. So I'm hopeful that we'll have a chance to do that.
Yeah, definitely. Also, I know that I'm not very smart, so might as well get some people in here and know what they're talking about.
Well, engineering is all about doing, and so you're doing it, so there's nothing to apologize for.
There we go. Speaking of, what are we talking about today? We should get on to the topic at hand, and we had an idea, and we'll see how it works this week, and if not, we can try something else.
Okay. Well, we had talked a little bit since this podcast is sort of jumping off from ground zero. We didn't know exactly which direction to take it. That we'd talk about where you jump in when you're given a design project. Somebody gives you a problem. It lands on your desk. You need to do something. Where do you start? How do you approach it? How do you deal with the expectations? So we'll talk a little bit about that today.
Yeah. And this is in the context of a larger design cycle, really. I mean, really there's any kind of, you can define a design cycle a lot of different ways, and we'll talk about that. But after you look at all the different parts of a design cycle from beginning to end, from concept all the way through to plopping something down on a customer's store floor, there's a lot of different pieces in there, and this is kind of the same thing. This is a podcast from idea in mine and Jeff's head and trying to plop it down in your eardrums. And we had to start somewhere. So we wanted to talk about the jumping off point.
Right. So in the big picture, I did a little research in the textbooks, in the same way that you have the scientific method, they kind of like to lay out the engineering method. The steps in this thing are very linear. They say, well, you start with, I'm taking now from a book titled The Engineering Design Process, which was written by Ertis and Jones, back, I think it was 1996. It may have been more recent. I'll have to check that. But, I noticed on Amazon, the going price is $130, but you can get a used version for $4. So you might want to go for the used version if this is important to you.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can handle the weight and the tattered pages, hopefully well used.
For $126, I think I can live with a few tattered pages.
Yeah, I can too. So, and you have read this?
No,
you have
no, I saw it like all other engineers. I found it referenced on Wikipedia. So,
okay. Hey, that's a good starting point, right?
So anyway, and I've seen this similar list. There was a textbook on engineering that I read a couple years ago that had a similar list, and I couldn't get through the first chapter because it gave this list of you do this, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and acted like every engineering project, you went through those steps in order. And engineering projects never go that way. They're always a mess. Any good engineering project is messy.
Yep.
But so just for the sake of completeness, let me go through the, I think there are 8 or 9 steps here. They talk about starting out with research, then doing conceptualization, feasibility assessment, establishing design requirements, doing a preliminary design, doing a detailed design, doing production planning, doing tool design. This sounds like it's gearing up for car production.
Yeah.
And then finally doing production. And that's a nice kind of laundry list of some of the things you have to cover. But engineering projects are never that neat, and there's always this iterative cycle that you go through.
That sounds like a book that a manager would kind of open up and be like, you know, maybe they come in from a different industry and say, I'm going to learn how an engineer works.
Right.
And then they go in and they read this, and then they create a checklist. They come out of their office and they say, all right, people, time to do research. And then in a few weeks, we'll be starting conceptualization.
Right.
And the engineers would groan loudly.
So, you know, I do mechanical design, and Chris, you do electrical design, but I'm sure there's a commonality in there where you're somewhere in the middle of the design and you go, oh crap, I forgot about that. You know, that.
Yeah, they didn't put this after feasibility assessment and then all the preliminary design. They forgot actually the section where the electrical guy curses out the mechanical guy for not giving him enough room in the packaging of the product.
Right.
And then later, of course, the mechanical guy curses out the electrical guy for whatever reason. I'm not sure what that would be.
Right. Well, my recollection is there used to be an Opel that had a bump in the hood because they kind of ran out of room for the intake on that thing. So
Opel being a car of some kind. Sorry,
a car of some sort. That's fine. So is mine. anyway, to that list, I just noted a few things that they're not including in there that I've run into a lot, which are you have to do debug. I mean, once you get the equipment into place, at least I was doing in industrial equipment, you had to do debug, you had to do a performance runoff, you had to worry about documentation, you know, what the parts are, how you rebuild it, how you repair it, how you maintain it. Somebody actually has to maintain the equipment. Even if it's an end product, you have to worry about maintenance and servicing customer needs, as well as improvements. And that can be a big one, is if someone hasn't documented the design well, you get a year and a half down the road and somebody says, hey, we need to fix this or change it. If the engineer isn't still on staff, you're in trouble if that knowledge is walking away from the company.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a post in my hopper of what happens. one of my podcast or my blog posts just about that situation, actually, about what happens when the designer walks away and all the knowledge goes with them. That's a horrible situation.
Yeah. Right. And once again, it sort of gets back to the idea of managers tend to see, especially non-technical managers, tend to see engineers as interchangeable. And so, you know, Chris walks out, Jeff walks in, no problem. An engineer is an engineer, right? But I don't have the knowledge that you have of that project. And sometimes it takes a long time to come back up to speed.
All we are is just another brick in the wall, right?
Exactly.
All in all, we're just another brick in the wall. That's it. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So if that's the sort of the big picture of, you know, an engineering cycle from beginning to end.
Right. And if we talk about the unrealistic nature of this and knowing that there's many more iterations than there are linearizations.
Right.
Then I think it starts to fall into place a little bit better. If you draw lots of loopbacks and, you know, mess ups and screw ups and the messy side of design, if people understand that. And
yeah, so you know, you read through, at least when I was younger, I would read through Inc. magazine and go, oh, these guys were geniuses. I mean, what? No matter what the business was, you'd read through that article and you'd go, this guy was brilliant. He looked at the market. He saw the market. He knew exactly where to position his people. They made a product that was right the first time. It sold great. He's genius. And I would go, how do I become that smart?
Yeah.
And it took me go ahead.
I did that, except I would look at, I'd get a men's health subscription and be like, oh, this guy works out three sets, 10 reps. And he, you know, he's super huge, jack dude on the cover of the magazine. I could do the same as well.
Right. Yeah. So it's never that way. It's the engineering process is always messy. And we do a disservice to engineers in school because we make it sound like every problem has a clean, you know, beginning, finish, and end.
Just like a good story, right?
Just like a good story. And maybe that's why they sell it, because it makes for a good story and we like those kind of things. But
that's right. But
when you come up to a design problem and you've given a project, you know, somebody says, okay, maybe they've given you the specs for the design or the specs for the problem, or they're giving you a couple background meetings. Now you got to jump in and you got to do something. And so
where do you start?
when you jump off into the problem, where do you start?
Oh, I wish I knew. I was telling Jeff earlier in the, before the show that I was just in this situation recently, because you can look at it. You can look at the whole swath of it, right? You say, I know that in a year and a half, say it's an 18-month design cycle, I need a product. And then you hear, oh, and you see the product in your head. And obviously there's, you know, it looks perfect in your mind, but whatever's in your mind right now is wrong. Right. And even if you were correct, even if you were 50% correct about that product and about what it's supposed to look like on the end and what the customer likes, you still don't know how to get there, and you don't know all the problems that are going to get in your way. And most of all, you might know what it looks like, but you don't necessarily know how it works. And so that jumping off point is key. Jeff, how do you jump off? How about that?
It depends on what the problem is. If it is something where from my engineering background, I immediately know how to work on the solution. You know, it's either a textbook type solution where you can jump in and start solving the problem. It's just a matter of, it's basically one big homework problem. Or perhaps you've done it just experience wise. You've seen a similar problem and you know how to, you know, get at the solution or who to call or how to work, you know, start coming up with ideas. That's not too bad. The problem is when you look at it and you haven't the foggiest idea how to do it.
Yeah.
You had sent me a link to a TED talk, by a guy,
Tim Harford.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Tim Harford, right? Not Hartford.
Right.
Yeah. And he was at Unilever and they were designing a detergent nozzle. And this is, a talk. We're about 10 minutes into the 20-minute TED talk, but they're talking about how they actually make dry detergent. And in the talk, he describes that they just tried a nozzle, basically. They just tried I think it was just anything, right?
Yeah, they were trying to make the detergent. They're taking the soap and spraying it through this nozzle to make the dry detergent. Was it something like that?
Yeah, it was like over a field, not a field necessarily, but a flat surface, and then it would dry, and then they'd flake it, and then it became,
okay,
you know, the flakes that go into your washing machine.
Right.
And so I don't recall how they started, though. Was it?
Well, they started with a nozzle, just it didn't work.
It was just a broken nozzle.
They had the idea they could spray this solution out and it would dry and it would make dry powder, but it didn't work very well.
So in that case, it's starting with a broken idea, which is a lot of times what happens, right? So maybe a marketer comes to you and says, our competitor has a product that doesn't fit the marketplace, or we make a product that doesn't quite fit this new marketplace and we need to do it. So you can start with a broken a broken piece of equipment, not necessarily broken, but doesn't work optimally for what the market needs. And I guess you could start from there and start analyzing what's wrong.
Absolutely. You've got to start when you don't know where to jump in. You've got to start with something, you know, you make your best guess and you try it. And that's the hard part for someone who hasn't come from a hands-on background, who's only done engineering analysis, who's done the calculations, but has never built equipment or built hardware. Sometimes the calculations are great, but the implementation just doesn't work, or there's something about the implementation that makes it difficult. And you have to start someplace. You do something to see what the result is. And based on the result, and this is kind of the heart of Tim Harford's talk, which is that you have to do trial and error. You know, if there isn't a proven analytical solution, you start somewhere and you just go at it the best you can. And unfortunately, that's extremely difficult for a manager to hear.
Yes.
Because they want to hear, I know what the solution is, and this is how long it's going to take, and I will be done in 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years or whatever the acceptable timeline is. They do not want to hear, I don't know.
Right.
But if you're being honest, sometimes you got to say, I don't know.
Well, I have this checklist and I have you down for 4 weeks for research. So go.
Yeah. So when you're in that situation, I think one of the biggest things is trying to manage expectations. When people mm-hmm. talk about this, they talk about, you know, managing time, managing cost, managing manpower, but not so much expectations, but you need to be aware of that, because if people get, I'll tell you how people get exceedingly high expectations. One of my favorite stories about the design process, or sort of parables about being in designing custom machinery, which I did for a long time, is what I call the happiness curve. And so for the person, whether it's an outside client or it's your manager, the happiest day in a project is going to be the day they hand off that project to you, because the problem has gone off of their plate and it's onto your plate, and it's no longer their problem. It is your problem.
And it's your problem.
And even if they've yes. signed a contract for a boatload of money, they don't care. It is now your problem. That is the day of the happiness. So if we start our graph at the day that they assign that thing, they assign that contract or they assign that project, time zero at that sign off, their happiness on the vertical axis is very, very high. It's at its peak. Now, if you've done a good job, if you're managing expectations, you're going to go back and as you get into the things, you're going to come back and say, hey, have you considered how much this feature is going to cost, or how it's going to, how much overhead it's going to consume? Or there's always, you know, engineering is a constant trade-off, and you're trading off one thing against another. And so you've got to come back to whoever your client is and say, hey, we've got some problems. You know, which do you want?
Well, we need to talk.
We need to talk.
Yeah.
And as a result, their happiness is going to go down. So I don't have a good units of time here. So we'll say at time one, when you've done this, you know, their happiness is decreased, say 20%. Mm. If max happiness was 100%, we're down to 80% happiness now.
Yeah. So at the first sign of trouble.
Yeah. And so now we're going to start getting into the detailed designs, the early, you know, you start laying out the concept and you figure out, hey, it's not going to fit in the production facility that we had planned. It's going to take a bigger space, or the power requirements are different, or you don't have the right type of air pressurization for the system. And so now suddenly a little more reality creeps in. And so at time equals two, whatever that time may be, we're down to say, let's say 65% happiness.
Okay. So this is it's asymptotic, is it?
yeah. And so
can we go negative?
Well, yeah. No, there's no negative. There's no negative.
There's just 0% happiness is the floor.
Right. Right. And you try not to hit that. It is possible to hit that. You try not to.
Yeah.
And so you finally start laying out the designs and the thing starts to come together and you start making progress. And let's say you bottom out at about 50% at time equals three. and by time equals four, you're starting to show signs of delivery, and now the happiness is rising and it's back to, say, 80%. It's not what it was, because it's not perfect. See, the day that they signed that off to you on day time equals zero, all things were possible. This machine or design was going to fix all the problems of the company. It was going to run perfectly. It was never going to fail. It was going to come in on cost, on time. But we're long past that, so we can't go back to 100%.
It sounds like a drug addict. How they can never get back to that first high ever again.
I'm not sure the comparison is right, but it's definitely.
I'm not sure either.
They're not going to get there.
Yeah.
So there's going to come at time t equals five, as we move along, or you're delivering the product. It's going to show up. You know, the first prototype rolls off, the product shows up on their floor, and happiness is back up to 90%. Let's say, because the day, at least the, you know, t equals five minus, just before that happens, there's great happiness, because there's resurrected hope that, you know, this machine, this design is going to solve all the problems.
Even though it won't.
Yeah, you and I know it won't. Well, they don't.
Right. We only because we cannot estimate the boundless nature of their expectations on day one.
Right. And so that's why, sort of the moral of this story is you have to manage expectations and keep people informed. Don't allow long periods of time to go without communication. Even if it's bad news, say it quickly. You know, get that back. No matter how bad the punishment, no matter the repercussions, say it now. Better to say it now than to wait 6 weeks and say it later. It's always worse when you wait. Yep.
Just rip that Band-Aid off.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So T equals six. We've delivered the machine and it's starting to produce things. And of course, when you first put it out on the market, there's problems. You know, something doesn't work. Something isn't up to spec. Happiness drops down to, 50% again. There's great gnashing of teeth. T equals seven. You start to get the bugs. You know, you go through the debug process. You get it working again. Happiness rises to, say, 65%. And now some long period of time goes, the thing runs in production. It goes on the market. It sells well for 6 years. And over this long period of time out to our next stop at T equals eight, they forget about all these problems, and happiness slowly rises once again until we're ready to start the cycle again, until whenever this T equals eight, however many years, months or years it is, they're happy once again. They've forgotten about all the problems and their happiness is 100% again, because they can drop the project off onto your lap and start the cycle all over again.
Very nice. Very nice. And so it all comes down to that 100% happiness on day one and the jump off.
Right. And letting people know, I mean, there's kind of people used to make fun of me just because when they would ask me to make commitments, I was always, they would call it hedging my bets, but I was trying to be honest with them. They'd go, well, you'll have it, you know, this will be operational in 6 weeks. Well, we'll do our best to make it operational 6 weeks. Here are the problems I see. Here's what might happen between now or then. I will keep you informed. I will update you every week on where we are, so that if there was a problem in week one, they knew about it before we got to week six and all of a sudden something wasn't working. But my experience has been, as an engineer, especially as a design engineer, you got to have that communication and you got to, keep updating people on the progress. People are willing to work with you if they know there's a problem, but they get really, really mad if there's a problem and they don't know about it.
So what I'm hearing here, Jeff, is that if today's episode is about jumping off,
yes,
and we were tacitly implying that the design cycle also applies to this podcast,
yes,
is that you and I should now try and lower people's expectations to just about as low as we possibly can.
It's too late because when they tuned in and they heard earlier this was going to be a podcast about engineering philosophy and they cared about that, Oh, their happiness is 100%.
Ah, we should have said that first.
But now they've listened to us for, 25, 30 minutes. Now they know better.
Oh, man. We have to do some major editing.
Yeah, maybe we just completely cut out that story about the happiness cycle, and then they won't know that.
That's right.
People more often remember, you know, not what the message was, but how you delivered it.
Right.
And that's kind of an awful thing for a lot of engineers who don't feel real comfortable with their communication skills.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
But it's in the same way that as engineers we deal with the physics of the world. You know, you got to, if a current is what it is, you know, if a force is what it is, you have to deal with it. And people are the way people are. They respond to how, you know, their perception of the situation is often more important than the actual facts of the situation. Not right. How we engineers would like it, but that's kind of how the world works.
Right. If you have a problem where a hammer is swinging down from the sky and it's knocking workers off their feet, showing a video of that happening is probably a lot more powerful than a graph of the jerk or the acceleration.
Right. Absolutely. Hence, I mean, just take a look at your evening news and you can see how the news articles they pick are focused on those that make an emotional impact as opposed to those that are actually delivering news.
Mm. There's another good show idea for us. Emotions in engineering.
It's
we can weep the entire show.
Yeah. Well, it's once again, if we're going to be as engineers, we're going to be effective in communicating ideas to society. If our ideas, if our knowledge is going to make an influence on society at large, we have to be able to communicate it. And sometimes there's some ugly aspects of that because as engineers, we're trained to be very focused on facts, to be try to be as rational as possible. And much of the world doesn't operate in a rational manner.
I agree.
It's unfortunate, but it's the way the world is. And we have to accept that just like we have to accept the laws of physics. You know, we have to work within that world if we're going to do what we do.
Yeah. So what else can be said about jump offs?
One of the other things that just sort of in terms of, you know, I talked about that we're often asked to manage time and cost and engineering effort. And one of my secrets is using pi as the magic multiplier.
Pi as the magic multiplier.
Yeah. So it has a couple of good benefits. One is...
So can I clarify real quick? So sure. This is... You're in a situation, you're starting a project, and you're being asked to do something. You have an end goal right. in mind. You know that you'll have to deliver something in the future. And now you're getting into the project, and you are using your rule of pi. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's
okay,
true.
Let's hear the pi.
So when you start, everybody will have a number in mind. Okay? I will tell you from... when I was designing production equipment, that pretty much on, you know, these were projects, the you know, the entire project was 100,000 on the small end up to 1,000,000 on the top end.
Can you quantify that some more? And so what kind of numbers are we talking about here? Could you give me a specific example so that we could maybe...
Sure. So a machine that would... I think we did a machine for a car manufacturer that was stuffing grommets into a windshield wiper bottle.
That's good. So, I like that.
So that would be just a standalone machine, you know, 3 foot wide, 3 foot deep, you know, 6 foot tall, couple of hand buttons to activate the machine.
Stuffer. I like it.
It would come down. It was a grommet stuffer, essentially. Yeah. So that might be you know, $80,000 to $100,000 for several of those.
So when you were saying 100,000 or 1,000,000 before, you were talking about dollars?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't add the word dollars to the end.
Because I was thinking quantities. Often I have, you know, ideas in my mind of how many number of products that are going to be sold in a commercial aspect. That could be 100,000 or 1,000,000 or even 10, right? So it would be 10 units.
Right. I apologize. I was thinking in terms of dollars and didn't specify units. And when you asked me to specify units, I thought, well, I was being perfectly clear.
People.
What didn't you understand?
So we were talking about the expectations at the beginning, and you were saying that everyone has different numbers in their head.
Right. So so I, from my experience, that engineering cost about 35%. If you took the salaries of the engineers and the, you know, the CAD equipment and the support equipment, it ran about 35% of the total salary, you, or the total cost of the project. You'd run about 50% on manufacturing. You'd run, I'm sorry, about 50% on components, and the rest would be manufacturing. So actually manufacturing is fairly cheap in the entire process. But what we found was when you, if you'd break this down and you'd say in a quote, okay, 35% is engineering and 50% is components, and the remaining, what would that be, 15% is manufacturing.
Yep, 15.
They wouldn't complain about the manufacturing. They wouldn't complain about the components. They said, 35% for engineering? Are you kidding me?
Right. I'm sitting here with you right now, and I don't care if I want you to go start this project today. I don't want to pay for that much, right? I don't know. Right. I don't think you're worth it, Jeff. That's what they say to you, right?
In so many words, yes.
Yeah.
And so if you, depending on the customer and what the situation was, what often happened was we'd start lowering that engineering budget. And so when we got done, the engineering would be, say, 15%, and the commercial would be 50%, and the manufacturing would now be, what do you think?
35%.
Yep.
Huh. That's weird, because I bet you were now working for manufacturing.
Yes. So
that design engineer is now a manufacturing engineer.
Right. So there are some... So again, this is perception, but we always called it, people were willing to pay for iron, but not for engineering. So if they're willing to pay for it, that's what we sold them. But the point is that they're going to have some numbers, again, with expectations. You've got to, you know, if there's a problem with money or there's a problem with time, you've got to start dealing with that early on. But my pi is the magic multiplier, is the fact that you'd set out a budget and, you know, let's say that everybody thought that, you know, this thing should cost, say, $100,000. Now, you can't really multiply that by pi. That would be a problem. But when it came to time and it came to engineering effort, pi would, especially time, pi would often be the right number, because as soon as you got into, everybody thought that you know, you knew all the problems and you could solve it in 6 weeks and it would take 18 weeks, or it would take 2 days and it would take, you know, 6 days. So I found that pi was a pretty good multiplier. Plus it was an irrational number. So when you gave them a number that was out to two decimal places, they were always pretty impressed that you had this estimate so accurately determined.
You want more decimals? I got more decimals.
I got as many as you can take.
Yeah. And also, you're being irrational.
Exactly.
You could stare them in the eye and say, this one's for you, buddy.
Yeah, and quite honestly, that wasn't far off. Especially when it came to time and effort. I guess those two. How many hours is it going to take? Both, and as you know, you can't put three engineers on a job and get it done three times as fast.
Correct.
I usually found it was always more than two times as long as we thought at the beginning, and it was often three or more. This is why when I was working on my own, I was always giving short-term contract, or I would break the job up into small pieces so that we would go, you know, I'd say instead of us signing off on a big contract, let's do 2 weeks. I'll charge you so many dollars. Let's meet in 2 weeks. I'll give you all my ideas when I'm there. Anything I've done in 2 weeks is yours. I'll give you all my spreadsheets. I'll give you all my drawings, and you decide whether you want to go forward or not. Hmm. If they wanted to, fine, but at least then I wasn't on the hook for a big contract for something that I saw big problems with, and they weren't on the hook to go with an engineer they weren't happy with.
So your jumping off point there was not only managing expectations by giving them a very short time span, but also giving them an out, giving you an out, and then saying, well, let's try it anyways. And kind of say, it's almost the same thing as we were talking before about the nozzle. It's saying, well, I don't know what this is going to be, but we got to start with something, right? And so it's all getting to that, we got to start with something.
Right. And we have that for today's podcast is that we're jumping in, we're trying something. If listeners don't like it, well, we can try something else. We're not going to go too deep into it before we find out what the response is.
Right. And you mentioned the lean startup idea as well. I thought that was interesting. Kind of this is a lean startups are kind of built on agile, correct? Agile methodology, and I'm sure that could be a whole episode unto itself. But the idea is you have a small idea, you throw it to the world, you see what they're thinking, and if they say, eh, not really, then you say, eh, okay. And then you pivot, as you said, Jeff, right?
Right. There's in the startup world, there's a hot selling book on, I think it's titled Lean Startups, something like that, but it's by Eric Ries. And, you know, the whole idea is that you, instead of spending lots of time and money putting together a full product, you try to find the minimum viable product, MVP, get it out there to potential users, see what the response is. If they respond well, then you keep proceeding forward. But more than likely, they're going to say, well, there's some aspect of it we like, but other aspects we don't. And you take that and then you do what they call pivot. You change exactly what your focus is to meet the same audience, but to change it in a way that's more to their liking. And so sometimes you have to make a lot of pivots. Sometimes you get lucky and you don't. But the idea is that instead of wasting lots of time gearing up for big production on something people might not like, whether it be a product or a service, you get it out there, you prototype it, you see what the response is. And if the response isn't good, then you shift to something else.
Yeah. And the real key is kind of creating that whatever, that first turd of an idea.
Right.
And there's a very good chance it might be a turd.
And that's, again, part of the, in engineering school, they don't tell you that that's, you know, engineering is messy. You're going to, you know, there are going to be a lot of turds of ideas.
Yeah.
To find that gem.
That's right.
Management may come down and say, hey, what were you thinking? This is an awful idea. And I've seen manager, you know, I worked for a company where they were changing, it was a medical device company, and they were changing the type of manufacturing, or type of product they were manufacturing. So it was an entirely new process. You know, the old manufacturing had no relationship to the new manufacturing, and the first attempt didn't work. And a whole line of managers got fired after that.
Whoa.
You know, basically, you know, in the engineering group, there were, I think, 5 or 6 managers reporting to the VP of engineering, and the VP and all the managers underneath them got fired within, or at least they otherwise left the company within, you know, a 6-month period.
That is not a good message to send to your employees.
But that turd of an idea got them started, and they eventually got it sorted out, and that became, you know, it became the main product for that company, and to this day they're selling it and making money from it. That doesn't help the staff and the managers that are no longer employed with them, but you got to start someplace.
Yeah. You got to take risks. That's I think, you know, in the context of school, you know, you have to take risks. You got to throw something out there. So perhaps that's a good place for us to end. A place.
Okay.
We've floated our turd of an idea, and we'll see how the world takes it.
Okay. Well, that sounds fine. I appreciate your letting me pitch in on this and the chance to share some of my ideas with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really good. I'm excited about it, and if it doesn't work, then we'll pivot.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
All right. Well, when we figure out a name for the show, we'll let everyone know what it is. Until then.